Hello, this is Rachel McElroy.
Oh, hey, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Oh, hey. Hey, what's up? I feel like we're too proper sometimes with our, like, we do a podcast and it sounds a lot like a podcast a lot of the times, doesn't it? Where it's like, hello, greetings, welcome. I want it to be more like we're in the hallway of high school.
Sup,
Reggie? Oh, man, I heard you failed the big driving test again. Reggie, come on. I heard you ran into the principal's Jeep with your Jeep. Reggie, come on, man.
What if we, every episode, only talk to Reggie?
That would be fun. We could do like those birthday videos on YouTube where we do whole episode, but then we go through and it's like, we all like to eat candy bars. Isn't that right?
Deborah.
Isn't that right?
Stephen.
We could have like a robot come in and fill in and people wouldn't even notice.
No, they wouldn't.
It's like those books where it's like you can put a kid's name in it and they're like, whoa, they wrote a book all about me. And you laugh like, no, you're so foolish.
I saw there, I'm looking, our son's birthday is coming up and I've been looking at superhero themed gifts and they have superhero books you can buy where you insert the child's name. But from what I can tell, That's it. There is no other personalization. It just says like Henry, comma, Spider-Man has climbed the building.
So this is wonderful. It's a show we do where we talk about things that we like, things that we're into. Do you want to talk about something that you like and something that you're into?
I actually got this idea as I was walking into your office. There is a book by Emily Oster. Called Expecting Better. And she has written other books and other articles, and she has her own newsletter. She is a PhD Harvard economist who looks at all the stats around parenting and pregnancy and gives you kind of more realistic advice based on those. So instead of just these kind of blanket guidance suggestions, it's more like, I looked at the actual studies and here's what actually was discovered and here's what is okay and here's what, you know, you might want to be cautious about. And it feels very data informed.
Yes.
Instead of like, you know, great grandmother informed.
It's astonishing to me. It was the first time around, and it's astonishing to me this time around too. For a pregnancy and childbirth is a process that so many people go through, and literally all people are the product of. And you would think that we would have really nailed down and codified like what actually happens during that. It is buck wild to me how much of that is still informed by essentially folklore. Like essentially things that our great 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 grandparents decided based on literally nothing, and yet we still kind of adhere to that. And this book is like an answer to that in a way that I think
she
is
also, when the pandemic started, offered some great guidance on kind of developing a process to determine whether or not you were comfortable sending your child back to school.
Yeah,
just kind of a way to weigh the pros and cons kind of more scientifically.
Yeah.
That I know a lot of people appreciated because these are hard decisions you have to make. Uh-huh. And to have like an actual process to do that has been helpful. So I just wanted to give her a shout out.
Yeah. I'm going to say tiny phone. I've gone through a few phones over the last like few years. I did like a Galaxy, some big Galaxy big boy. And then I had a big, big iPhone. And I was so excited about the big, big iPhone when I got it because I was like, it's a screen I can watch a bunch of stuff on. But then I didn't really do that very much. I just got the 12 mini and it's so tiny. It's so light. I can fit it. A lot of the times I would struggle to fit the big phone in my pocket. And now I've gone back to the tiny little phone that was like, you know, the original iPhone 4 size, like little guy. And I'm like, oh, little guy, I missed you. I forgot how easy you are to hold and move. And if I drop it on my face while watching a video at night, it doesn't like give me a black eye.
It's so darling to me the way the trend cycle of it has to be bigger. Bigger is better. And then it's like, oh, but we want small now.
Look at that little guy. Yeah. I love him. Who goes first this week? Because I have proven myself a pretty unreliable tracker of that. I think it's me.
I think it's you.
It is me. Okay. Thank you, wonderful.fyi. My first thing this week, I'm really excited about because it was something I'd had kind of stuck in my head for a while, but I couldn't really put a name on it. I want to talk about a primary school art class. Does primary school describe everything like pre-collegiate? I don't think I've ever really known what that term means.
Secondary is high school.
Okay.
And then post-secondary is college.
Okay, so I guess elementary through high school art class. Really, I guess elementary and middle school art class. I feel like in high school, by the time, if you're taking art class in high school, you have proven some level of proficiency with art in a way that my elementary and middle school experience did not necessarily require. I was always wild about like elective style classes like this, I guess, to put it in sort of high school terminology. And it is a disaster that they are not taught or prioritized in early education anymore. Because like I was really academically averse growing up. Like I did not really care that much about math and science and stuff. Like I wasn't bad at them, but I just like they didn't light me up in a way that art class did, even though I don't really have an artistic bone in my body. And what got me thinking about this, what got me thinking about like how dialed in I was to art class was
how much you want to paint me,
how much I want to paint Rachel. Yes. I'm really good at that.
Yes.
But what really got me thinking about this was a dude named Mark Kistler. Mark fucking Kistler. Do you recognize that name? Do you recognize his brand at all?
I mean, no, I don't think I do.
Okay, Mark Kistler was basically an art educator who made a bunch of like art lesson videos and had a couple PBS series that we would watch in art class in elementary school and middle school, I think, where he would teach techniques. And he had two main shows that he did that taught these techniques. The first was The Imagination Station, which was sort of like a general, like, kid-friendly, like, you know, here's how to do perspective, here's how to do these different things. His other show was called Commander Marks, The Secret City, and this show fucking rips. And I watched some episodes of it on YouTube, because there are some, and I'd forgotten about it. It was, like, deep, deep, deep down in the memory banks, like teetering on the edge of oblivion of me just forgetting about it forever. So Secret City took place in this weird sci-fi fiction where Mark Kistler played Commander Mark, who was like a space commander who was exploring these cities that he would draw. And every sort of drawing would take place on this huge, like, whiteboard-sized canvas. And in each episode, he would focus on a different technique, like shading and perspective. And he would focus on teaching drawing 3D drawings with these, like, dynamic drawing techniques, like forced perspective and shading and things to sort of simulate 3D illustration. He would do this by adding more and more things to this one enormous drawing of a secret hidden space that he would just kind of improvise as he went along. And there were other kind of like space creatures, sci-fi creatures who would like chime in every now and then. And to me, as somebody who was not particularly artistic and was not very capable of, you know, recreating his techniques that he taught in these videos, but watching somebody draw a map of like this futuristic city from nothing, or like this secret underground like tunnel world, was to me like the coolest shit in the entire universe.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I have never heard of this, but I can see why it would appeal to you, because a lot of what you do in early art class is you just try and recreate things that exist.
Yeah.
So this idea that you would use it for like world building, I can see it would be
so cool.
Super cool.
And I would encourage you, like, if you're around my age range, the 33-year-old sort of group, and you had art classes in your early education, I encourage you to search on YouTube for Mark Kistler, because watching these videos like really, really, really hurled me back in time in a way that very few things are capable of doing. I really like the idea of teaching art techniques rather than teaching just sort of general, like, okay, kids, sit down, here's some red paint and some yellow paint and mix them together and that's orange. You just got arted. And more like, here's how you can have the tools to draw whatever the hell it is you want to draw.
Yeah, I don't ever remember learning technique.
Yeah.
I feel like the class was always like, here's a thing, make it. And you
express
were kinda
yourself.
Like, well, I guess I'll see what I can do.
And having those techniques be based on these fantasy and sci-fi worlds. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I loved it so, so, so much.
That's really brilliant. Yeah, I always kind of worshipped... Well, I don't want to say always. I've definitely had some bad art teachers, but I will say that that is a profession that I always admired.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you went to art camp, didn't you?
And yeah, every summer.
Yeah. And so, like, you definitely had a lot of exposure to this. I will also say, like, I, you know, talking in general about art class, I also did really like the just go make a thing. Because like I said, like I didn't take a lot of pride in my academic work necessarily. But I remember very, very distinctly when I started thinking about like early art classes, like the projects that we would work on for like a whole week. Like I remember very clearly making a paper mache mask of my face and painting it. And it looked so bad. Like it looked so terrible and it hurt quite badly to take it off of my face after I sculpted it on there. But at the end, having this thing that I made, having this mask that I made and painted, and it was unlike anything else anybody had ever made in the whole world and history of time, like that was so appealing to me. Like that was so, so, so cool to me. And I would come home from school. My parents would be like, what did you do at school today? And I wouldn't remember like, oh, you know, we read, you know, Red Badge of Courage. We read Johnny Tremaine. I would be like, look at this shitty mask I made. We would use clay, not like on a sculpting table, but just sort of like molding clay that you could then sort of like glaze and bake and have like a really roughshod little cup. Yeah. And again, like I would be like, hey, I finally cracked, you know, the order of operations of math today. But screw that. Look at this tiny little cup I made.
So no part of you ever like wanted to be an artist. You just always kind of enjoyed it.
Oh, I think there was definitely a part of, and this was the great thing about having these art classes, is that like everybody that I went to elementary school with doodled and everybody drew and everybody like, no matter like where you landed on the like popularity social spectrum of that school, like you were interested in some regard in art. And I don't think that's like something that you can accomplish with the way that art is currently kind of built into the core curriculum. There's the, I'm sure I'm, you know, all about this because you're like in it. But a lot of art education in schools these days takes place in the form of arts integration, which is about like integrating visual or performance elements into the everyday curriculum of math and language and science and all of those things, which benefits in a lot of ways the core curriculum, right? Because it makes students pay closer attention to math and science and engage with it in a way that maybe they wouldn't without that artistic thing, but it doesn't necessarily build up the art education side of things.
Yeah.
It uses art to benefit core curriculum instead of the other way around.
Now, I have an exact example of this. When I was in high school, we were told to make an alternate cover to the book Grapes of Wrath in our English class.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, okay, not really understanding what was happening or why we were doing it. And
yeah.
Just being like, well, this is fun.
Well, and ever since the emphasis was placed almost entirely on standardized test scores and No Child Left Behind came along and more or less made it prioritize that, arts education has been slashed, right? The budget for National Endowment of the Arts in with regards to like how it would benefit schools has been slashed. And so there's not much room for art and music classes and stuff like that. And that's where you get things like arts integration and saying like, oh, I hope that's enough. And it's not, because you don't make the thing. And then that's what I'm saying. Like I was good. I was a good test taker and I got good grades in school, but nothing that I accomplished with regards to like my GPA ever came close to like my pride in making a shitty cup or a shitty mask. And I think that's kind of heartbreaking. This is kind of a two-in-one, because I genuinely love the things that I did in art class, but most of all, Mark Kistler out here. Everybody, regardless of whether or not you grew up watching him, watch some of The Secret City. First of all, it's got that 80s PBS aesthetic that I am like so crazy about, but also just like watching this weird mustachioed jumpsuit-wearing spaceman like drawing basically like sci-fi Fraggle Rock is like absolutely the coolest shit in the whole world, so... That is my first thing.
Okay. My first thing is a little themed in that it is the floating character balloons in parades.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this a thing that happens much outside of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade?
I mean, you know, there's the Christmas parade,
oh,
too.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Then a lot of places will have like a July 4th parade. I don't know that they have the floating character balloons
as much. Yeah, sure.
And given that these are big budget items,
yes.
I don't know that you'd find them in your home city. But yeah, I mean, I was specifically thinking of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade when I did this. I always like, I don't know. If I'm watching a parade, like, that is what I'm looking for.
Absolutely.
You know, like, I enjoy a marching band. And I will even tolerate sometimes, like, a reproduction of a Broadway number. But what I'm looking for are those balloons.
Those big balloons. And especially when they go wrong. And I don't want anybody to get hurt. I never want to see anybody get hurt. But watching Mr. Peanut just, like, dead draped over a telephone pole or something is my absolute aesthetic.
I have a great suggestion for you later in this segment.
Okay.
Because I looked up that very thing.
Fantastic.
I was like, I want to talk about this. I was like, I also want to know the terrible things that have happened.
Okay.
So the balloons are typically between 60 feet long and 30 feet high. And each balloon needs around 90 handlers. And there are all these rules around the handlers. They get training because of the enormity of these balloons.
Sure.
So you have to be at least 120 pounds in good health. And then you go to a training where you kind of learn about the, like, geometry and physics of balloon handling. And then you test it out on the field. And there's a team leader. And then there's also a police officer that marches with each balloon in the parade.
Okay. If just quick question.
Yeah.
Never thought about this. There's 90 handlers. If as a prank, 89 of them coordinated to all let go at the same time, would somebody go flying up into the heavens suspended on a big Pikachu?
I mean, yes, probably. So they used to just be filled with air, but now it is a mix of air and helium.
Why? How would they float if it was just air?
Well, so they used to be attached to cranes.
What's the point?
Well, I guess so. In 1958, there was a helium shortage. And so they, yeah.
How is it just get more helium? What?
I don't know.
It's in the air. Just get helium.
I don't know the history of helium.
Hold on. Where's helium come from? Hey, wait a minute. If you had asked me, Griffin, where's helium come from, I would have told you helium tanks, like, at the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
But then there's another step after that, isn't it? Which is like, how do they, it doesn't generate inside those tanks. So where does the helium come from?
I mean, my answer would be science, which I know doesn't necessarily answer your question, but feels comfortable to me.
Like, you put air in a centrifuge and you spin it and there's a little bit of helium at the, but what? Where does helium come from?
Nobody knows.
Farms? Farms?
Probably farms.
It's like at the top of a corn silo. It's just, it makes helium up there and you scoop it up in the tanks. Oh, Jesus. Can we stop doing the episode for a second so I can Google where helium comes from?
You probably should. So balloons started in 1927. They replaced, so the parade actually started 3 years earlier, and they used to put live zoo animals on floats. And then I think they realized there were several problematic things about that, moved to balloons, started right away with the big ones. Just didn't even, you know, scale up slowly. Just
went right for
just
it.
Just big right away.
I just started imagining an alternate version of Miracle on 34th Street where, like, Santa's up there on the Santa float. And everybody's like, wow, that guy really looks like a rhinoceros. Get out of the way. The giraffes are chasing the children.
Why did we do this?
Why did we think this was a good? Look at that Santa. He looks so. Oh, he's been eaten by four lions. They've drawn and cornered the Santa Claus.
So this kind of speaks to just kind of the nature of American history. When they first started creating these balloons, they did not develop a plan to deflate them. So at the end of the parade, for several years, they just released them into the air.
That's so much worse than I thought you were going to be like, they shot them with guns. They fired a big harpoon into them.
That might have been better. They just released them.
And then they were like, this is somebody else's. Good luck, everyone. This is going to land on someone.
Yeah. So there were several things that led to them stopping doing that. First, Felix the cat caught on fire. They released him and he got caught in a high tension wire and burst into flames.
Cool, cool, cool.
So that was one incident. Another was, a Tomcat balloon, 60 feet large, was released and a woman who was taking flying lessons ran into it. And they used to offer a reward to anyone who retrieved and returned the loose balloon.
What?
And so there was speculation that she was trying to get the award by running her plane into it. Luckily, she was with a flight instructor who helped her kind of regain control of the plane.
With a big inflatable cat wrapped around it? Yeah. How do you come back from that?
Don't know, but she was able to regain control of the aircraft, luckily.
That's good. Okay.
But yeah, so this was 1932, and they stopped just letting them go.
That's so fucking funny. God, okay, again, I don't want anybody to get hurt. But the idea of at the end of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, everybody just being like, okay, there goes the big yellow M&M.
And just like the reports of people in their apartment buildings, like calling and saying, I think I see a UFO. Oh, no, that's Snoopy.
Yeah.
Never mind. The parade was yesterday. I forgot.
Yeah.
And also just like to put a reward out there, you're encouraging people to like
fly their planes into them. Yeah, no, it's a flawed system. That's why I'm saying I'm strongly in the corner of shoot these balloons and make them die and go to balloon hell. And then that way planes won't run into them. I think that's the ethical decision.
So that the example I wanted to give is exactly of a balloon that was put towards balloon hell. And I didn't want to give, there are examples of people like actually getting injured. Like there are rules now around not doing these balloons on like high wind days. And I think I've watched a parade before where they have delayed it just to try and wait out the weather.
I remember learning that if one of these balloons runs into like a light pole or a telephone pole, the telephone pole loses and falls right over and will hurt anybody nearby.
Yeah. So the example, and there's a 4-minute video of this, is 1997 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with Barney the Dinosaur.
Oh, no. What'd he do?
So super high winds. There were several accidents during that parade. The Barney the Dinosaur, so this 4-minute video shows from somebody's apartment building. The dinosaur is kind of going back and forth on either side of the street. And you can hear the crowds just kind of like gasp as it hits like their side of the street. And you can tell that they can't control it. And there are like people, like three handlers to a cord trying to like hold it down.
Oh, God.
Eventually it is knocked into a street light, which tears it open and starts to deflate. But the winds are still strong. They can't get it down. And so at the very end of the video, there are police officers swarming the balloon with knives and stabbing holes in it to release the helium.
Okay, I do want to see that. I do need to see that.
I ended up there's a certain point when you're watching the video where you're just like, all right, I know what's going to happen. Let me just get to it. Like, I was surprised that the video was only 4 minutes because for the first minute, I'm like, when are we getting there? So I just ended up...
I don't know that I would have anticipated a Julius Caesar style assassination of Barney.
You see the video at the end, and it's just these uniformed officers just triumphantly walking away from this corpse.
With their hunt. Okay. Who made that call? With the NYPD, there's no way they were prepared for this situation. So somebody would have been like, all right, everybody, you got knives? Get in there.
I mean, I think...
this is our moment, lads.
I think... I'm going to disagree with you. I think they have to have been prepared for that situation. Like
there was a room at the police station where they're like, all right, y'all, you know the plan. We're going to have a lot of fun this year. We got a new yellow M&M floating up there. We're really excited about that, but knives at the ready.
It was definitely kind of scary to watch, but the thing that is most enjoyable is that when you think about the fact that it is Barney the Dinosaur and just...
what are you guys doing?
The children watching this and watching their, you know, their like television hero just mortally wounded over and over again.
Yeah, that must have been rough to watch. Hey, can I steal you away?
Yes.
Thank you. We got some gumbo prawns here, do we? This one is for future Sam, and it's from past Sam, who says, "Hey Sam, it's past Sam. When you're hearing this, you've either just started your last semester of your bachelor's degree or you're finishing it up. Listen, you don't give yourself enough credit for the work you've done, and I am so proud of you. I hope that everything is going well, and this message from your favorite people finds you happy." Congratulations on that bachelor's degree. You know, for the longest time, I didn't know what that meant. And my idea of what it did mean was so cartoonishly wrong. I thought it was just like a like a thing for like single folks to go and learn a little bit of, you know, pre-med or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that ends up not being the case. And I'm not a particularly intelligent man.
You make a good art project, though.
Oh, do I, though? A nice plastic grocery bag holder made out of, yeah, oh boy. Made out of a tissue box.
This next message is for Micah. It is from Andrew. "We've come a long way since meeting as bar trivia teammates, and I'm so lucky to have your humor, depth, and kindness in my life. Your D&D adventures are epic, your art is inspiring, and your company brings me so much joy. Though our trivia team always lost, I've never felt more like a winner than when I'm spending time with you. I love you."
That is so, so nice.
That is so nice. But you gotta remember bar trivia?
Yeah, you gotta tighten it up. You gotta tighten it up. It's all about finding your weaknesses. For us, it was sports. So we found ourselves a sportsman, and his name was Chaz, and nobody liked him. He was a total tool, a terrible person. Damn it, he knew so much about sports.
Yeah.
Carried us to victory, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I miss Chaz. Whatever happened to him? Let me Google. Boop, 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 boop. He got run over by the Wienermobile.
That's
kind of good.
I can remember as a child thinking it was odd that here was this can full of meat.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week on my show Bullseye, David Letterman on Shame, Regret, and canned hams.
Is this the best delivery version of pork?
That's this week on Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Can I do my second thing?
Yes.
I was kind of surprised we haven't talked about this. You did a small wonder once a long time ago on Lollapalooza, but I want to talk about music festivals in general because I think I've talked about this on the show. I'm suspended in this weird state of maybe being too acclimated to our current sort of situation where when I see like movies or TV shows where people are gathering somewhere, it weirds me out. It makes me like uncomfortable. So maybe this seems like it strangely bumps up against that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like I follow the Austin City Limits Instagram account and they will post pictures occasionally of previous concerts where people are just shoulder to shoulder.
Yes.
And I think the idea of standing that close to that many strangers like seems crazy to me now.
Yeah, I definitely fell off of this scene as I sort of aged out of them, I guess.
Yeah.
But there's a part of me now that like thinks about, you know, when quarantine has ended and the pandemic is, you know, more or less over, this being like a pretty wild way to get back into the world.
Yeah. Can I just say, it blows my mind that you went to Bonnaroo repeatedly.
Yes, 3 times.
It just seems so counter to a lot of your traits, I guess.
Yes, it absolutely is. That's the main thing I kind of wanted to talk about. Concerts in general make me a bit anxious. Like being anywhere with a big crowd where I don't have access to like the kinds of amenities that I count on, like a bathroom access, a chair, like those make me a little bit anxious. And a music festival sort of takes that anxiety and multiplies it by a billion, especially something like a Bonnaroo where you don't know, like you're going to sleep in a tent. There's no electricity. There's some porta potties, right? Like that's not great. And ACL and a Pitchfork Music Fest are like the other two that I've been to a bunch. That takes care of it a bit because in both those situations, I can just go home and go to sleep. But like something with like a camp out element is like,
yeah. Oof.
Where am I gonna poop in the morning? Because I actually know the answer to that, and it's not a great place. And also, I'm gonna have to wait like a half hour before I can get in it.
I was gonna say, Griffin and I have known each other for 9 years now, And we have been camping once, and that was for a friend's birthday celebration.
It did not go well.
It did not go well. And we do not own tents. We do not own sleeping bags. Like, it is not something that either of us tend to choose willingly.
But this was 2006. This was 19-year-old vivacious Griffin. The world was my oyster. No, I mean, I still definitely had those anxieties back then, right? Like, it was not... I was in a really weird place in 2006, right? My mom died in 2005, basically as I was graduating high school. And then my first year of college was a fucking mess. Like, I was, yeah. I had very little, I was excited by the opportunity to kind of have a clean slate and be whatever I wanted to be, which is not, you know, that is not exclusive to going through a sort of major shakeup like I was going through. Like, everybody goes through that. But I, for whatever reason, like, the limiters were taken off completely. And, like, I lost my scholarship. And I was just like, I made a lot of really shithead decisions, both in like how I was treating myself and the types of people that I was like kind of trying to assimilate into. And by the summer of 2006, like, I had kind of realized the error of my ways, especially when I lost my scholarship. And yet, like, this opportunity presented itself to go to Bonnaroo. And it was such a like wild, adventurous thing. The first concert I ever went to when I was when I was 18, was in 2005.
Yeah.
Was when I went and saw Ben Folds in Cleveland. That was the first concert I ever went to. And then, like, less than a year later, I went to a music festival in the middle of hot-ass Tennessee and saw dozens of shows. And thinking back about it, like, so much of the music that I still enjoy now that, like, informed my music taste growing up in my adult life, I discovered at music festivals. Like, the first time I really listened to fucking Radiohead was when they headlined Bonnaroo 2006. I was in the audience like, so what are these guys all about? And then, like, whoa, oh, man, because they basically played all of OK Computer front to back. And I was like, holy shit, this is so good.
That is a great point, because it's so accessible. You know, you buy this ticket and then you can walk, you know, 20, 30 feet and discover and new different, music.
Exactly.
And it makes it very easy for you to just, because that always happened to me. I would go looking forward to one or two shows, but the shows that I ended up loving the most were the ones that I wasn't expecting to see.
Absolutely. It was eye-opening in a way that was far bigger than, oh, I found some new bands I like. It was eye-opening in a way that, like, this is a life experience that, like, I didn't know that you could have. And I think that's what helped me sidestep a lot of the anxiety that I would have about being sort of way out of my element, is that I was so far out of my element that I saw completely new elements that I didn't really know existed. It's the same way that I think that, like, travel is genuinely an important thing for people to do, because seeing how the world operates outside of your bubble is, like, I such an essential component of developing, like, empathy and open-mindedness. This was kind of similar to that in a way, because it was, I was so uncomfortable and I was so in the unknown that, like, it genuinely was sort of life altering in a way that, like, changed what I knew about the world and also changed what I thought about myself and, like, what I was capable of doing. And also, there was dope ass music everywhere. Like, it was such a cool environment. And also, like, there's a kind of thing that is, like, only works in that environment. Like, there are certain concerts that are the Flaming Lips I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I've seen them in a music festival setting twice, and both times was just like, I'd never seen music like that before. I'd never seen a concert like that before. And that's sort of the Flaming Lips' like whole like aesthetic, I think. The first time I saw them was at, I think, 2006 Bonnaroo, and they were playing on a headline stage, and they passed boxes of laser pointers out through the audience. I think I've told you about this before. And they just pumped this fog machine out so that, like, you're shooting lasers through the fog and, like, making your own sort of, like, disco display. But at one point, the words "Shoot Wayne" appear on stage, and he pulls out this huge parabolic mirror and just, like, refracts all of the lasers back into the audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that. There's a lot of, like, side attractions at a Bonnaroo and at other festivals. But I feel like Bonnaroo is sort of like designed for it. Like the Sonic Forest, which is just this huge field of pylons that you walk through, and as you touch them, they like make different noises. And the Silent Disco, which has like spread far beyond music festivals at this point, where there's a DJ playing into wireless headphones, and so everybody's dancing, but to the outside observer, it's like completely silent, and everybody's dancing to nothing. Those things are designed for very high people, I think, people who are very high on drugs, which fortunately for me, back in my late teens and early 20s, I was one of them, so it was like enjoyable in that way. But like stuff like that, I saw Beastie Boys play with Nas in like one of their like last performances. And that was like a thing now in the future, like very grateful that I had the chance to experience. And back then was like out of my fucking gourd.
Yeah. You know, you're describing it and it's making me think about the fact too, like both you and I didn't get a chance to travel internationally until we were in our like mid-20s.
Right.
You know? And so this was kind of an opportunity to experience this kind of feeling of travel, you know, in the United States.
Yeah.
Like there's something about going to a music festival that feels like going to a different country.
I think what we're talking about, and I can probably generalize this feeling beyond travel or music festivals, because I also recognize like I was, I was very fortunate that I was able to do this. I had like a part-time job that I was able to save up money and spend basically all of it on Bonnaroo. But there's this, not to get too like out there, but because this will for sure make it sound like I'm high at Bonnaroo, but there's like this weird subconscious collective like level that I feel like at a really good concert you can get on of just like this like everybody's kind of at the same place right now, and there's this like kind of unspoken energy that we're all tapped into. And I think you can get into that with travel, like finding new parts of the world and seeing like how other people deal with that energy or whatever. But like at this kind of environment, at a Bonnaroo, at a big arena music festival where everybody's into the same thing, like you can get that at concerts everywhere. I feel like at a good music festival it's designed to elicit that. And that's such a special thing. Like that is such a genuinely, I scoffed at people who talked about that kind of thing going to like a Fish concert or a Grateful Dead concert or whatever jam band shit. And I still am not a big jam band fan, but like, I for sure get it. I for sure get it after going to something like this. And I would encourage like anybody going through, you know, a particularly transitional period of your life to like do some weird shit that you don't think you would like at all.
Yeah.
That has the potential to be like huge for you in that way. So like, again, like the thought of going to a Bonnaroo now at 33, like is not appealing at all. The thought of having two kids and trying to make something like that work is, I can't process the math behind it. But like an ACL, like a music fest that is more sort of approachable and, I don't know, infrastructurally sound, yeah, is something that I didn't give a shit about last year or a couple years ago, but now like I miss being a part of that sort of collective, you know, subconscious sort of realm.
And that like creative space,
Sure,
like that's a very cool thing to be a part of.
Yeah. What is your second thing?
My second thing is Short.
Martin Short. So fucking funny.
My second thing is very unique to me probably, but I imagine some listeners will relate, and that is in-laws.
Oh yeah.
I as everybody who listens probably knows, I am pretty fortunate. And that I have a good group of in-laws kind of in my corner. But I think for me as an only child with like, a pretty small family, it was really exciting to like be a part of this family and have the opportunity to like be an aunt, you know, and to have like brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law and all that stuff.
Right.
And I think, it's like people always kind of talk about their in-laws in kind of a negative way. And I can understand why people would have that circumstance. Because a lot of times you are with people that have very different beliefs and outlooks than you do. But for me, it was just something that I just always felt very fortunate for, to have that like bigger family kind of baked into getting married.
Yeah. Know? It's kind of, it almost reminds me of the stuff I was just talking about of like, whenever you do a sleepover at somebody, one of your friends' houses, you're like, oh, this is how your family does things. This is like a very permanent version of that. That can be very exciting when it's not like terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And to have these kind of like traditions baked into it, and also to have this kind of resource to find out more about your partner.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like the first time that Griffin brought me home for Christmas. I just remember just basically interviewing your dad, be like, bring me all the Griffin materials.
Well, I also feel like there's a certain very common type of in-law that like is so excited to dump that on people. Yeah. Like all of my family and like the Smurls. Like I feel like Mary Smurl, Justin's mother-in-law, like rolled up on you the first time she saw you, like, you gotta see this dude as Horton in Seussical. It'll change your shit.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's another example of what a, like, unique circumstance I had was that I was not ever tested, you know? Like, the in-laws were not, like, demonstrate your worthiness.
Yeah, sure.
It was more like, oh my gosh, Griffin brought somebody home, this person.
Oh, you were being viciously tested. You may not have realized it because you did really well on the test, but oh my, you were on the rain-slick precipice of just being completely jettisoned. But you did so good. You did so good.
We did. I mean, there were board games involved. Like, and oh, yeah. In some ways, that could have been considered a test.
The crucible of gaming.
The thing that I didn't really know about until I did research is the whole concept of in-law and, like, what it actually refers to.
Oh, yeah.
So I always assume that, I think a lot of people assume that it is just like you enter into this like legal partnership with your partner when you get married and that gives you legal ties to their family. But in-law actually started as a reference to canon law, which is the church's set of rules around who you can and can't marry.
Whoa.
So the idea is that in the Catholic Church, for example, you couldn't marry a non-blood relative of your spouse if they passed away.
You couldn't marry a non-blood
relative. So your spouse's siblings, parents, children, you weren't allowed to marry them.
Okay.
So father-in-law was a way of saying, like, hey, going forward, if things don't work out, like this,
I never knew that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It also used to refer to step-siblings, step-parents. So a father-in-law could either mean your spouse's father or your mother's new husband.
Huh.
So people used to say, like, if your mother got remarried, that would be your father-in-law. But they've since stopped saying that as much.
Because it's very confusing.
It is very confusing. Yeah. The earliest written mention comes in 1894, an article that states the position of the in-laws is often not very apt to promote happiness. I was trying to do more research on this, and a lot of it is just like surviving your in-laws or like ways to approach your in-laws successfully. And I will say another circumstance we have that is, I think, frustrating, particularly now being so far away. You know, if we were in a Everybody Loves Raymond situation and it was
that's the dream.
Like an everyday popover,
yeah.
I might feel different. Uh-huh. The distance, I think, makes it seem more special to me because it, you know, is usually like happy circumstances that we get to see our extended family. I feel really fortunate for it. I think it is a way to kind of exponentially grow your family. And if you're lucky, they are people you like being around.
Yeah, absolutely. I love my in-laws too. I have to say, I feel like they listen, but David and Linda are crushing it. They keep it so real.
Like, I don't have any brothers or sisters. So like when you met my parents and like, you know, a few of my aunts and uncles, like that's it.
No, you got a way better deal. It's just for the money, you got way more sheer tonnage of in-law.
When I think about how complicated it might be trying to navigate all the time, if I also, you know, had siblings and extended family, it would be tricky for us to kind of manage. But as it is, it's pretty stress-free,
yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Hey, can I tell you what our friends at home are talking
about?
Yes. Well, how about this one from Anna? This one's from Anna, who says, I recently taken up tap dancing again by following video tutorials, and my small wonder is getting all the steps right in a combo for the first time. I bet that's cool. I bet that feels real good.
I love that. You know, I took dance classes when I was a kid for a very long time. And tap shoes, I feel like my family was always worried would damage the floor some way. And so it was very hard to practice at home because it was like, are you tapping?
God, you gotta, but I understand, like you go to Savion Glover's house and it's like a bomb went off in there. It's horror. It's like he's been sword fighting in there. It's untenable. LT says, my small wonder is the YouTube channel Ordinary Sausage. It's a man making sausages out of everything. For example, an entire poo-poo platter, or my favorite so far, canned clam chowder. It makes me laugh very much and reminds me of old YouTube. One man, one slightly disgusting trick, less than 5 minutes per video. We're going to watch these tonight.
Yeah, we have found our new disgusting food-related fix.
Chef Club ain't getting it done anymore. Chef Club's sold out.
You know what's weird is that it's predictable. Mm-hmm. Griffin and I can narrate a Chef Club video in like 3 seconds in. And I've realized now, like, that makes it less fun. Like,
yeah.
I know what's going to happen next. Uh-huh. I know where they're going to put the cheese.
They're going to stuff the gooey cheese inside the weird chicken apple pie. And like, that's yawn. Thank you to Bowen and Augustus for the use of our theme song, Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. And thanks to Maximum Fun for having us on the network.
Yeah, thank you to Maximum Fun for airing a very special, wonderful promo that we just recorded.
Yes!
And I would encourage everybody to go and check out some new shows. I think it's a good time now to just spice up your podcast ritual.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, don't stop listening to us. That would,
yeah, please.
But supplement us with more great podcast from MaximumFun.org.
Oh, and speaking of McElroy products, if you have not bought a ticket for the Mabim Bam Sawbones live show,
yes,
There's still time.
You can find links to tickets and everything at themcelroyfamily.com. And it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be really weird. We haven't done a live show since March, so who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But we'll have fun. I think that's it, and we're going to stop doing the show in just a few seconds now. But before we get there, it's very important that we tell you. Oh, nope, here it comes. Bye!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.